This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. What if comparing car insurance rates was as easy as putting on your favorite podcast? With Progressive, it is. Just visit the Progressive website to quote with all the coverages you want. You'll see Progressive's direct rate, then their tool will provide options from other companies so you can compare. All you need to do is choose the rate and coverage you like. Quote today at progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Comparison rates not available in all states or situations. Prices vary based on how you buy. Futuro.
I think the access to a valet is something very important to a lot of community members, to a lot of people. And I think sometimes the people who are able to vote sometimes take that for granted. And they don't vote. That to me is they're denying their rights when other people wish they had those rights.
From Futuro Media, it's Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa. Today, New York City has a chance to become a national model by offering voting rights to non-citizens. We are all witnessing our country undergoing a contradictory era in terms of voting rights. Despite a devastating pandemic, turnout in the 2020 election was the highest we've seen in more than a century. The results of that vote, though, have been doubted, denied, and remain subject to drawn-out controversy and auditing, even though there's no evidence of fraud.
Around here, it's suburbia, so you have that split vote. People feeling disenfranchised one way or the other.
This comes as Attorney General William Barr issues a new memo paving the way for prosecutors to investigate claims of voter fraud, even though none have been substantiated. Key Republicans like Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell are also supporting the president's refusal to concede.
I believe that Donald Trump won the election. I believe that they tried to steal the election.
On January 6th, thousands of people, either claiming fraud or simply desperate for a different result, stormed the Capitol building, looting offices, waving the Confederate flag, and crying for politicians' heads to roll. In the months following that harebrained and deadly insurrection, revolts against the vote and seemingly against democracy itself have not disappeared. They've just taken a quieter form. In what's amounting to a concerted effort to block the vote, especially of underrepresented groups, Republican-led state legislators have proposed and enacted laws to severely restrict voting access.
Georgia's Republican Governor Brian Kemp has signed a sweeping elections bill that civil rights groups are blasting as the worst voter suppression legislation since the Jim Crow era.
There's a number of items here that have voting rights groups very concerned. Let's start with mail-in ballots and boxes. There's restrictions on when people can actually access those boxes. Now it's only going to be early voting hours, and there has to be a person physically standing over the box when someone drops off their ballot. And if those conditions are not met, Stephanie, you could be looking at a civil penalty of $25,000.
We're asking my Republican friends in Congress and states and cities and counties to stand up for God's sake and help prevent this concerted effort to undermine our election and the sacred right to vote. Have you no shame?
The moves limit how, where, and when people can cast a ballot. Overall, nearly 400 voter suppression bills have been proposed in 48 states this year. All are part of a tide of anti-voting bills that first-term Georgia Senator Raphael Warnock has called Jim Crow 2021. It's a reference to the often violent codes instituted after the Civil War that persecuted Black people and targeted potential voters.
We may be tempted to dissect these bills as if analyzing them piece by piece makes them more rational. But that narrow analysis only obscures the larger, unmistakable picture. This is a full-fledged assault on voting rights, unlike anything we have seen since the era of Jim Crow.
22 of those bills have already become law. Meanwhile, New York, the largest city in the United States, is taking the right to vote a step further, seeking to extend the franchise to non-citizens. If passed, the bill called Our City, Our Vote would allow non-citizens with work authorization, people with green cards, DACA, or temporary protected status, to vote in all municipal elections. It would also open the gate for the largest addition of eligible voters in 50 years. Producer John Washington in New York City brings us the story.
Amid voter suppression bills proposed in almost every single state, there are also efforts to move in the opposite direction. Two federal bills, the For the People Act and the John Lewis Voting Rights Act, both seek to nationalize voter registration and mail-in voting standards, as well as reinstitute protections from the 1965 Voting Rights Act. But with Congress at loggerheads, passage of the bills is unlikely. New York's Our City, Our Vote bill, meanwhile, could add nearly 1 million registered voters to the city. The move would be the largest expansion of the franchise since 1971, a half century ago, when the 26th Amendment lowered the voting age from 21 to 18. All of this raises some basic questions about democracy. Who are counted as the people when the people supposedly rule? What happens to a government of and for the people when millions are left out of key decisions? What about the rallying cry of the American Revolution, no taxation without representation, when so many in this country are taxed and have zero say in who represents them? I recently spoke with some of the advocates for the New York City bill and people who could become eligible to vote about what casting the ballot means to them. I also delved into the history of non-citizen voting in this country. What I found might surprise you. Lucia Aguilar, whose voice you heard at the beginning of this story, has been living in New York City since she was 3 years old. She works at a nonprofit in East Harlem, where, for the last 16 years, she's helped manage a community food bank. She has a green card, is deeply involved in local politics, but still has years to wait until she can apply for citizenship and pull the lever on voting day.
You know, growing up here, going to school, you learn about the democratic system, and I believe in it and that we all have a say when we vote.
But that is exactly what Aguilar doesn't have. She's a New Yorker through and through, but simply doesn't have the same say in the direction of her city as many of her neighbors.
I wasn't born in the United States, but, you know, I'm a New Yorker at heart, and I wish I could participate in these events. You know, I'm dying. I'm having like a countdown to when I could submit my citizen application so I could, you know, finally get to vote.
Immigrants can obtain legal residency through just a handful of channels. Some are granted hard-to-get asylum or refugee status, which the government has been, over recent years, increasingly miserly in bestowing. Others are sponsored by their employer or marry a U.S. citizen. And very few are lucky enough to win the Green Card Lottery, a federal program that benefits 50,000 foreign citizens every year. All have to wait at least 5 years before they can apply to become a U.S. citizen. In the case of Lucia, that won't happen until 2025.
A lot of people who know me, they ask, so who did you vote for? Or who are you voting for? And I can't vote. And, you know, it's... sometimes I feel ashamed not to be able to tell them, oh, I can't vote. It's just sad that, yes, like we are sharing this community, but I don't have a say in it.
The bill, Our City, Our Vote, is set to give people like Lucia that say. The New York Immigration Coalition is one of over 60 organizational backers of the bill. Paul Westrick, their senior manager of democracy policy, explain to me why they're pushing for the proposal.
While we live in a democracy, we have, as I said, 1 million New Yorkers who can't vote in their local elections for mayor, for city council, for the folks who are making policy and budget decisions that affect their lives on a day-to-day basis. So these are residents of our city who live here, work here, go to school here. They are raising families here. They are paying taxes here, and they deserve to have a say in the direction of our city.
Non-citizens represent well over a million New York residents. They come from all over the world, with the largest foreign-born populations belonging to the Dominican Republic, China, and Mexico, according to the most recent statistics. Immigrant New Yorkers, both naturalized citizens and non-citizens, pay over $10 billion of taxes a year. Non-citizens contribute nearly $3 billion into that total. New Yorkers used to be able to vote in school board elections, but after years of mismanagement and complaints, school boards were eliminated in the city in 2002, their control handed over to the mayor and an appointed board. Currently, New York also runs participatory budgeting, which allows all residents to vote on the allocation of some municipal discretionary funds. But as Paul says,
there is nothing that replaces the right to vote for your elected officials, your elected leadership. There is no substitute accountability, nothing that will substitute for the right to vote.
The bill comes at a critical time. Especially over the past year, the city's debt to and reliance on immigrant workers has been profoundly, painfully underscored. As the pandemic gripped New York in 2020, immigrant workers were critical in holding the city together, keeping New Yorkers fed, caring for the sick, and keeping the city itself alive. And yet they also suffered the worst of the pandemic.
Half of our frontline essential workers are immigrants. One in five of those essential workers is a non-citizen New Yorker. These are nurses and medical professionals. These are the folks who have been preparing and delivering our food, keeping our buildings clean, keeping our grocery and pharmacy shelves stocked. So this is a population of folks that we have classified as essential to our city. New York City cannot run without them. So how can we ask these New Yorkers to quite literally risk their lives to keep us healthy and to keep this city running, while also then denying them the right to vote in how their taxes are spent and who represents them in government? We're telling immigrant New Yorkers that we need them to continue to put their bodies at risk, but that we don't really care about their voices. And that is not the New York City that I think most of us believe that we live in or want to live in.
I spoke with one of those frontline workers Paul mentioned.
My name is Hina Naveed. I'm 31 years old. I am a registered nurse.
She's also a recent law graduate from CUNY School of Law, and when we spoke, was serving as a campaign manager for Cesar Vargas, a candidate for Staten Island Bureau President. Despite being unable to vote herself, Hina has been door-knocking and volunteering to get out the vote for years.
The fight for justice and dignity for undocumented immigrants has been something that I've been very passionate about for a very long time. I am a DACA recipient, which means I'm undocumented. I have a work authorization that I have to renew every 2 years that allows me to work to pay taxes, but doesn't give me a path to citizenship. And so for me, what that has essentially boiled down to, for me and millions of undocumented immigrants, is taxation without representation.
Hina is now pursuing a career in law and politics, but her experience as a nurse in the time of COVID and some of the dynamics and inequalities of the city it helped expose has left a substantial mark on her outlook.
I remember during the height of the pandemic being an essential worker as a registered nurse, literally being on the front lines of this pandemic, working in different settings and being deemed essential. However, not essential enough for citizenship, not essential enough for the right to vote.
How can a city so obviously depend on and tax and in large part thrive because of one segment of the population and yet in many ways ignore them? Our city, our vote would give people like Lucia and Hina the chance to go to the polls, to hold the politicians who make decisions over their lives and who spend their tax dollars accountable. It's also, according to supporters, a down payment on the basic health of the city, a reaffirmation of the very idea of democracy. Here's Paul of the New York Immigration Coalition again.
The more folks who are in the process participating in our democracy, the better it is for the entire city. This is an opportunity for New York City to really lead the country and lead the conversation in protecting and expanding voting rights.
Granting non-citizens the right to vote may sound like a radical project and certainly attracts its critics. Stanley Renshin, a professor of political science at City University of New York, sees voting as an incentive for people to, as he put it, jump the line.
When people jump the line and they are given an incentive to do it and a reward for doing it, it undermines faith in the system as a whole. And that's a very big and important issue for America as a country.
It's worth noting that for many people across the world, there really is no line, and migrating legally to the United States is an impossibility. Still, allowing non-citizens to vote is a practice with a long history in this country, and isn't so rare in other parts of the world either, including in Ireland, Sweden, and Australia. There's also a number of U.S. cities that already let non-citizens cast the ballot.
Coming up on Latino USA, we dive into the history of immigrant voting rights inside and outside of the United States. We'll also hear from people on both sides of the New York voting bill debate, as well as some non-citizens hoping to be able to head to the polls soon. Stay with us. No te vayas.
Support for Latino USA comes from Odoo. If you feel like you're wasting time and money with your current business software, or just want to know what you could be missing, then you need to join the millions of other users who switched to Odoo. Odoo is the affordable, all-in-one management software with a library of fully integrated business applications that help you get more done in less time for a fraction of the price. To learn more, visit odoo.com/latino. That's odoo.com/latino. Odoo, modern management made simple.
Hey, we're back. In the first part of our show, we looked at the history of non-citizen voting in the U.S. We're going to hear the arguments from people for and against the proposed bill in New York City and how this could influence similar actions in the rest of the country. Here's producer John Washington.
Jamie Raskin is the Maryland congressman who was tapped to lead former President Trump's second impeachment trial. But long before he entered into politics, he wrote an influential article in a law review journal that was passed around among voting rights advocates. It was a key resource in implementing non-citizen voting rights in Tacoma Park, Maryland. Non-citizens in Tacoma Park have been voting in municipal elections since the 1990s, without either uproar or issue. In fact, Maryland is a state with the most cities, 11 in total, that allow non-citizens to vote for their local leaders. Other states where foreign residents can vote are Illinois and California. Here's Raskin.
For most of American history, states granted voting rights at the local level to non-citizens. This was a standard practice in the 18th and 19th centuries implied by the property qualification for voting. Prior to the Civil War, pro-slavery forces tried to destroy non-citizen voting because immigrants overwhelmingly opposed slavery. But Abraham Lincoln and the Republican Party vigorously defended the practice of extending suffrage rights to permanent residents who were on the pathway to citizenship. The Republicans made the compelling argument that we all benefit when everyone participates in their communities. That argument is still compelling today.
To understand more of that history and the current practice of non-citizen voting, I spoke with one of the global experts on the topic, Ron Hayduke. He is a former director of New York City Voter Assistance Commission and currently a professor at San Francisco State University. Ron is also the author of Democracy for All, Restoring Immigrant Voting Rights in the United States. Here's Ron.
Most Americans are very surprised to learn that non-citizen voting or immigrant voting is older than the country itself. Many of the early colonies allowed immigrants to vote and run for office, and they did.
Ron explained that when Congress created new territories, it used the appeal of non-citizen voting to attract settlers.
And when those territories became states, it kept that practice intact. Not only the promise of free land, again, stolen from Native Americans, but real power and inclusion.
It's worth noting that Native Americans did not become U.S. citizens and therefore couldn't vote in national elections until 1924. After the Civil War, with the Reconstruction Amendments, the 13th, 14th, and 15th, which abolished slavery and guaranteed equal protection of the laws and the right to vote, there followed a backlash and a backsliding in terms of voting rights, especially in the South. White Southerners used poll taxes, literacy tests, intimidation, and brash violence, including lynchings, to try to scare Black people away from voting booths. The institution of Jim Crow also, paradoxically, occurred at the same time the South let more non-citizens vote. An 1874 Supreme Court case, Minor v. Happersett, upheld the state's rights to implement their own voting regulations, even if they were extending them to non-citizens.
They used immigrant voting as a means to say that they're expanding the vote, but not for these folks, or to say that it's only white males that are the true stakeholders.
But even as some non-citizens were able to cast ballots, women were still officially denied the vote, and Black people were largely blocked from the polls until the Voting Rights Act of 1965. This is Lyndon B. Johnson, the president who pushed to pass the bill.
Our fathers believed that if this noble view of the rights of man was to flourish, it must be rooted in democracy. The most basic right of all was the right to choose your own leaders. The history of this country, in large measure, is the history of expansion of that right to all of our people.
But it was in the North where immigrant voting rights were first scaled back. And by the late 1920s, most states and cities had stopped allowing non-citizens access to the ballot. While voting has increasingly been restricted to immigrants in the U.S., parts of Europe and Latin America have gone the other way, extending voting rights to non-citizens.
You can move to Ireland and in 6 months vote in national elections. And they've seen significant turnout to good effect, right? We've seen changes in policy, like in Sweden, there's a number of studies that have showed how when immigrants participate, there's increases in and improvements in education policy and outcomes. So again, the evidence kind of overwhelmingly shows that there's a generally positive outcome.
In terms of our city, our vote, it's important to underscore that it's absolutely legal for cities and states to allow residents, citizens or not, to vote. While it's illegal for non-citizens to vote in federal elections and they can face prison time if they try, there remains some dissonance in the interpretation of the law.
That Constitution was submitted to the people on a one-man, one-vote basis and was adopted by the people.
In 1964, the Supreme Court took on a case, Reynolds v. Sims, which addressed the unequal apportionment of state legislatures. Based on a fundamental principle of democracy, the justices struck down an Alabama law that crookedly carved up voting districts. As Chief Justice Earl Warren wrote, undoubtedly, the right of suffrage is a fundamental matter in a free and democratic society. In another voting rights case, Gray v. Sanders, from 1963, Justice William O. Douglas wrote, "The conception of political equality from the Declaration of Independence to Lincoln's Gettysburg Address to the 15th, 17th, and 19th Amendments can mean only one thing: one person, one vote." But much like person used to legally signify only free white men, even today, the idea of one person, one vote isn't as simple as it sounds. This brings us back to the idea of no taxation without representation, and other axiomatic slogans that drove and centered the original concepts of American government. And not just American government, but the principles of governance that were followed or at least hailed across the globe. Article 21 of the United Nations 1948 Universal Declaration of Human Rights states that the will of the people shall be the basis of the authority of government. But whose will? Grand conceptions of political equality are thrown out the window when it comes to immigrants. You can pay taxes, serve in the military, own property, go to school, be a working, contributing, and fully engaged member of the community. Yet you can be arrested by immigration authorities while picking your kid up from school. In many states, you can't legally drive, and in almost all cities, you can't even vote for the mayor. Ron Hayduke, The expert we heard from in the first part puts it this way.
You know, it's basically about inclusion. It's about fairness. The idea is if you pay taxes, if you're a community member, you should have a say in who are the representatives that enact law and policy that affect your lives on a daily basis. You know, I think we're having a national sort of reckoning in some ways today regarding our inglorious past, from the displacement and genocide of Native Americans to the enslavement of African Americans to the exclusion of women and other groups or to their marginalization. You know, this question that's sort of burning and being debated in lots of ways. Who's an American? What's America? What's this American project about? And I think immigrant voting sort of helps cut to the heart of it, because it gets at these questions about who are we? What is the best way that we should organize ourselves as a society? And questions of inclusion are at center.
New York Councilman Idanez Rodriguez, who sponsored the most recent iteration of the Our City, Our Vote bill, sees it pretty clearly.
We have close to 1 million New Yorkers that they have green cards, they have working papers, they pay the taxes, they did the contribution during COVID. So for me, it's about the recognition of the work that those brothers and sisters have been making to the city. This is not about doing these things as a favor to those immigrants, those poor people. This is about, it is the right, we are late, and we should correct it. And I think that this is the right thing to do.
But adding nearly a million potential voters to a city with 5+ million registered voters is no small thing. It's hard to know how city politics might be shaken up. I asked them about political consequences.
The consequence is that we're going to be expanding voting rights. They're going to be empowering most New Yorkers to take control of who are the leaders, and those leaders will be accountable. This is about, if people pay taxes, they should elect the leader. And if anyone have a different approach, then they should move to another town, another country that has not been built by immigrants.
Critics of the bill see it pretty differently. Here's Stanley Renshin again, the professor at City University of New York, who talked about jumping the line.
There are many different ways to have your voice heard. And I've listed some of them. You can contribute money, you can work for a campaign, you can work, in a civic organization, and so forth. And all of those things are, I'm gonna use the word apprenticeships. They're like democratic apprenticeships. They're learning the ropes, they're learning what the country's like, you know, the ins and outs and ups and downs of a country. And those are things that you can do legally here.
Essentially, he worries that non-citizens wouldn't have the knowledge of their communities to be able to make informed decisions, and that besides voting, there are other ways for non-citizens to be politically engaged.
Americans inhale America. They grow up here. They listen to their parents speak English. They know their grandparents, their friends, their brothers, their sisters. They go to school. They watch the TV. You know, by the time an average person is born into the United States, by the time they're 12, they've absorbed a hell of a lot of culture. And there's just no substitute for that kind of experience. You can't buy it at the grocery store.
He acknowledges that plenty of Americans can be ignorant of some aspects of political and civic life, but still thinks the bill is a bad idea.
You're being given the vote with no effort. And I'll tell you what I mean about effort, because there's something there. We want immigrants to become Americans. And it takes some effort. They have to navigate a new culture. You know, they come over here, you know, wherever they came from, it ain't New York. And so they have to learn it. It's not easy. We know it's hard, but it's worth it. And in part, you tell us something about your interest in us by how worth it you think it is. So on balance, you know, I'm a big on balance person. And, on balance, it's an unnecessary and not a good idea.
Ron, the global expert on voting rights, does see value in the New York bill.
You know, we look back in history and say, oh yeah, that was wrong to exclude, you know, African Americans and women and young people. Well, why not for immigrants too? You know, we talk about immigrant inclusion and empowerment, especially in New York. Well, okay, let's make it real.
Looking beyond New York City, there are 25 million non-citizens living in the United States, with about 12.3 million green card holders and 11 million or so undocumented people. That's about 8% of the total U.S. population, people who are of voting age and have no say in the policies that affect them. Except for the well-heeled and well-connected, the path to any legal status in the United States is nearly insurmountable. And even for those who by wealth, family connection, having suffered severe persecution, or by blind luck are able to snag green cards, plenty of hurdles still remain before they can become citizens and register to vote. After becoming a legal permanent resident, you still need to wait 5 years, pass a civics test, an English language test, drop $725, and dodge getting swept up in the zealous criminal justice system. Only then, if you're granted citizenship, can you sign up to vote. Here's Senator Warnock again.
America is a land where possibility is born of democracy. Our vote is our voice, a chance to help determine the direction of our country and our own destiny within it.
Of course, those 25 million non-citizens have a voice, and many of them use it beautifully and powerfully. And yet, politically, there's no doubt that those voices are also muffled. As the New York bill gained momentum early this summer, I went to a rally in Corona Plaza, Queens, where those voices were raised.
When immigrants are under attack, what do we do?
Stand up, fight back!
When our voices are under attack, what do we do?
Stand up, fight back!
When our future is under attack, what do we do?
Stand up, fight back!
Queens is the most diverse of New York City's five boroughs, with a population of more than 1 million immigrants, including 660,000 green card holders and approximately 500,000 undocumented people. With a 7 train clanking overhead, street vendors hawking tacos, backpacks, and Tupperware sets in the background, about 100 or so politicians and supporters gathered to promote the bill.
My name is Dalma Lama. I'm a community organizer, community volunteer, and a community lover. So I am a representative of the whole Nepali community, and I'm here to share my voice and give the voice to my community. This bill is very much important to us because we have about 45,000 documented people who are not eligible to vote just because they do not have a citizenship.
I asked Dalma what specific issues would drive non-citizen Nepalis to the polls in New York.
I would say the most important issue is always language justice. Language barrier has always been such an important and crucial social issue that we have been fighting. My community has full support in this bill, and we are going to demand it. We're going to fight it.
I also caught up with Catalina Cruz, a state assemblywoman who is formerly undocumented and described this bill as personal.
So I'm here to support, not only because I used to be one of those folks. I used to be undocumented. I used to not feel like my voice counted, and I want my neighbors to feel respected.
I asked her what would change. Giving voice, as she and many others put it, is one thing. But what will newly enfranchised people do with that voice?
We could see more dreamers in office. We could see more formerly undocumented people who now have the power in office. We could see more immigrants in office. We could see more people that are black and brown in office. We could see more people who believe that all of us deserve a right to have our voice respected.
For Francisco Moya, a council member, passing the bill is a goal close to his heart.
My mother, she's a resident. She's never had the opportunity to vote for me. She's always wanted that opportunity. As she sees me, you know, on TV, and she sees the palm cards and all of those things and all of the newspaper clippings that she keeps in a scrapbook, she's very proud. And my mom has worked and paid taxes, and, you know, she's on a pathway to citizenship right now. But this would give the opportunity for my mom and a million other residents here in New York that share similar experiences and have similar stories, but have one thing in mind, which is having a voice in local politics. And this would give them that opportunity.
Another supporter of the bill is Tiffany Caban, former public defender who captured the nation's attention as part of a new progressive approach to DA's offices when she ran for Queens District Attorney in 2018. She narrowly lost that election by less than 100 votes. I spoke with her in June, days before the New York City primary, in which she was running for city council.
It's not difficult to imagine a number of recent close races, including, you know, one of your own that I can think of, that may have gone very differently if a bill like this were already in place. Is that something that you think about?
All the time. I think about it all the time. Mostly, I think about it in a little bit of a different context. I think about how we have systematically disenfranchised Black and brown voters through criminalization, right? That we have taken away the right to vote. And I have consistently said that if we re-enfranchised every person that we have taken away the right to vote because of criminalization, we could literally turn every single election in the country, full stop. And I think about the same way with our immigrant communities.
What concrete political, like specific things do you think would change in New York because of a bill like this?
A ton of different things. I think that you might find that we would have stronger workplace protections that made sure that our immigrant neighbors didn't have their wages stolen, that their status wasn't weaponized by employers, that safety standards in workplaces are raised for them. We would see that as we are building out the capacity of our healthcare system and saying, hey, we have to build not just more hospitals, but more clinics, and understanding at the city level, the Department of Health and Hospitals is the first point of care for most of our Black and brown, low income, and yes, immigrant communities, that we are building out clinics that prioritize being able to give comprehensive and culturally competent care, right? That there's language access.
What about nationally the importance of this bill? Do you think this is like maybe setting a marker or potentially could be an example of trying to push back against like anti-voting or voting restriction laws?
One, we could be a model, right, for across the country at the municipal level that hopefully would be scaled and adopted at state and federal levels. In terms of theory of change, I think it always starts at the local level and building out a bench of support and modeling it and showing that it works and that it results in a more just community, infrastructure, government, democracy, and then making the case for it at every level of government to the point that it can't be denied.
Let's go back to Hina, the frontline worker. She asks a simple question.
And how do we hold our elected officials accountable? By voting. And that's what it all comes down to. And so that's why this fight is so important to me. I want to make sure that all New Yorkers, regardless of immigration status, regardless of background, have the right to vote. We've seen that it works in participatory budgeting, where regardless of status, you're able to have input on where discretionary funds are allocated. And it makes a difference. People feel more connected to the community that they had a say in. And that's why I'm pushing for this.
I asked her if stories like hers, of people unable to vote, but who are productively and abundantly engaged in the community, might help us get us closer to the full promise of democracy.
Whatever it takes for them to recognize that everybody has value inherently, undocumented immigrants, just like legal citizens, are contributing to this economy and are essential in ensuring that it gets back up and running, and they deserve the right to vote. They're worthy of the right to vote.
In late June, the Justice Department announced it was suing the state of Georgia over its new election law. It alleged that the bill was rushed through the legislature and that its intent is to deny Black voters equal access to the ballot. The Justice Department may bring similar suits against other states. Meanwhile, with a supermajority of council members, New York's Our City, Our Vote bill could be up for a vote later this summer. By the way, you can read a print version of this story on The Nation's website at thenation.com/New York Vote. This episode was produced by John Washington with help from Julia Rocha. It was edited by Andrea Lopez Cruzado and mixed by Julia Caruso. The Latino USA team includes Marta Martinez, Mike Sargent, Julieta Martinelli, Victoria Estrada, Patricia Zulbarán, Ginny Montalvo, Alejandra Salazar, and Reynaldo Leaños Jr. with help from Raúl Pérez. Our editorial director is Julio Ricardo Varela. Our supervising senior engineer is Stephanie LeBeau. Additional engineering by Leah Shaw Dameron with help from Gabriela Baez. Our digital editor is Luis Luna. Our New York Women's Foundation Ignite Fellow is Maria Esquinca. Our intern is Oscar de Leon. Our theme music was composed by Zenia Rubinos. If you like the music you heard on this episode, stop by latinousa.org and check out our weekly Spotify playlist. I'm your host and executive producer, Maria Hinojosa. Join us again next time. And in the meantime, look for us on social media. I'll see you there. Bye.
Latino USA is made possible in part by W.K. Kellogg Foundation, a partner with communities where children come first. New York Women's Foundation. The New York Women's Foundation, funding women leaders that build solutions in their communities and celebrating 30 years of radical generosity. And the Chan Zuckerberg Initiative.
You know, my father just last year was able to vote for the first time in his life. I hope he voted for me, by the way.
I'm Maria Hinojosa. Next time on Latino USA, celebrated poet Ada Limon revisits her debut collection, Lucky Wreck, celebrating its 15th anniversary and its re-release. That's next time on Latino USA.